My wife used to have an aspiration to write. So one Christmas, I bought her a book on how to write a book. And I was amazed at the simplicity of it. And I'll tell you what it said. First of all, you pick out a hero and a heroine. And then you get a few people around, you know, just to support them conversation-wise and so forth. Then you select a villain and surround him with a few black-hearted people. And then you choose a scene in which the two are going to confront one another. So you start out, build the hero and the heroine way up, and then the villain moves in, cuts them down. And just before they're going into oblivion, they rally and come up again. And then the villain cuts them down again. And then they rally. So the story is simply a struggle in their confrontations. Now, if it's going to have a happy ending, why, the hero and the heroine have got to win in the end. And their victory has to be so significant that it has a positive effect on all posterity in the future. Now, there are things that distinguish a good story from a perfect story. One of these is the degree to which you can identify with the characters. So as we go through this morning, if you approve of what the hero and the heroine are doing, well, give them a hand. And if you don't like the villain, give him a boo. And a hiss, whatever you want to. We want you to identify. Another thing that makes it great is the surprises. Now, if you read along, you can anticipate what's going to happen next. Like a Horatio Alger story where pretty soon you lose interest in it. But this thing's got one great surprise in it. It's got several, but one great one. Okay, with that in mind, let's take a look at it. Now, we're going to start with the setting, however, before we introduce the characters. This occurred during the reign of Xerxes, was his secular name. The word Ahasuerus in here is an honorary title, like Your Majesty. It isn't a name. Xerxes was the king. He ruled over the greatest world empire, geographically, which has ever existed. And we find here that it was divided into 127 provinces, over which he exercised loose control from India to Ethiopia. Now, I've gone from this route on a jet, and at 500 miles an hour, it's still a considerable trip from India to Ethiopia today. But that's the extent of the kingdom. We see in verse 3, in the third year of his leadership of this great Medo-Persian empire, he called in the 127 governors for a six-month banquet and celebration, during which they lived it up. And they had so much money, they couldn't spend it, so they decided to spend a lot of it on themselves. And he was going to show them how really wealthy and well off they were. Now, that's quite a party, wouldn't you say? 6 months? Now, if you were involved in a six-month banquet, and then the end came, don't you think you'd be reluctant to leave? I think you'll get kind of attached to this place in just 4 days here and be a little reluctant to leave. But what about 6 months? Well, that's what happened. They just couldn't bear to break it off. at the end of 6 months, so they extended it another week. If they hadn't extended it for another week, we would never have the book of Esther. Now, can't you imagine that with this many high-powered people, there's a lot of competition as to who the best tennis player and who's the this and who can tell the biggest story. And in 6 months, you kind of run out. Now, I think that the king, although he was probably a good leader, didn't show up too well in the competition. Maybe he's kind of a loner, I don't know. But he said something during this extended week that set all these events in motion. And what he said was that his wife, the queen, was the most beautiful woman in all the empire. Somebody apparently challenged him on that and said, how come she's always got a veil over her face? So he said, I'll show you. Everybody meet over at the auditorium, you know, in 30 minutes. And we will bring in Queen Vashti to show off her beauty. And you will see that I'm married to the most beautiful woman in the world. So they all gathered in the auditorium. There's no indication in here that the 127 governors brought their wives with them. So I think this was, mostly an all-male crowd. So they got over there, waited for Vashti to come in. But nothing happened. And the king sent for his closest messenger and said, tell Vashti to hurry up. So he made another trip. This time he came back. And in a voice loud enough for everybody in that auditorium to hear, he said, Queen Vashti says she's not going to do it. She's not going to come. Now, I think she's to be admired for this, because this was not in keeping with the modest tradition in effect at the time. There's a hint that the king was not only asking her to do something immodest, but maybe a little burlesque in here. But she said, I'm not coming. My guys really sized this up in a hurry. And they said, oh. Verse 17. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they despise their husbands in their eyes when it shall be reported. Xerxes commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. Now, when we get home, first time we tell our wife to do something, she will say, Queen doesn't obey the king. Why should we obey you? That's simple. And they said in verse 18, thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. Well, they had a crisis in the kingdom. So Xerxes got all of his advisors together. What do we do? They concluded there was only one solution. They had to fire the queen and replace her as an example of what would happen to wives that wouldn't obey their husbands. So verse 22, they sent letters into all the king's provinces to the effect that every man was still ahead of his house and that the wives were to obey their husbands. Hope I'm not getting off to a bad start here. I mean, this is just what the record says. Verse 20, all wives shall give to their husbands honor, both great and small. That's what it said. Now, I think that God didn't have anything whatsoever to do with chapter 1. But this situation, having been created through human fallibility, God moved in. So in chapter 2, we introduce the hero and the heroine. The hero's name was Mordecai. We talked in the earlier session about after the 70 years captivity, the Jews were spread throughout the empire. One of them ended up in a pretty good job. He had the double job of being in charge of the king's, the royal family's personal security. And he was a chief of protocol who made all the appointments and screened every caller on the king. Now, is that a pretty good position, you think? He'd work himself up to that position. So he knew what was going on. Nobody could see the king without being screened. He was responsible for the safety of the royal family. We notice in verse 5 that he was a direct descendant of Benjamin, and between Benjamin and him, there was a king by the name of Saul, who was a descendant of Kish. We'll come back to that in a little bit. Naturally, he knew that the king had fired the queen, and they were looking for a new one. So they apparently had Miss Universe contests throughout the empire, and they took 1 year for the eliminations. So Mordecai, although he was a Jew, he had living with him a cousin whose parents had been killed in the dispersion. And he said, Esther, you enter in the contest, local Miss Universe contest, but don't tell anybody that you're a Jew. So she did. And to get on into the story, verse 15 of chapter 2, now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail and so forth, came, Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. Verse 17, the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Year ago, totally unknown. Now, the number one woman in the world. Okay, you happy with her? She done all right? Now, about this time, we see in the latter part of chapter 2, there was a plot to assassinate the king. Mordecai found out about it. And verse 22, Esther gave him the word. Now, verse 23, when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. So Mordecai not only has a strategic position, but now he has further ingratiated himself by saving the king's life. He doing all right?
Yeah.
She's number one in the world. Mordecai has done all right for himself. So it's time to introduce the villain. This was no small job, running the largest empire in geographic extent that's ever existed. Pretty big challenge, wouldn't you think? And I think Xerxes decided that he needed some help. So he decided to appoint a deputy. The man he picked out was a man named Haman. And you notice that his ancestry took him back to King Agag. Remember what happened between Saul and Agag? Saul lost his throne. That was the chain of events that started his downfall, was his failure to deal with Agag the way God told him to. So here, 400 years later, you've got confronting one another a direct descendant of Saul and a direct descendant of Agag in key positions in this great world empire. Now, Xerxes was smart, and he knew that in order for Haman to do his job, he had to have authority and authority to go with the responsibility. So King Xerxes made him a co-equal and gave the command that any place Haman went, he was to be given the same honor that the king himself, which meant everybody had to bow down, do reverence to him. Well, old Haman took the job, got sworn in, and the first day he went in to check with the king on some routine business, and all the guard, all the people knew what the decree was, and what did they do? Bowed down to him. Except the guy in charge of the guard. Verse 2. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Well, the guard was really shaken by this. They had swift justice in those days. The way it worked, anything the king didn't like, he'd just say, off with his head. And he had somebody stand behind him to execute it. So you'd think twice before you disobey anything the king said. So they said, you're going to get us all killed, Mordecai. How come you, one of the top people, don't carry out the king's command? So Mordecai told them, and this fits in with what we did in the earlier session. He said, I will not bow my knee to anybody except Almighty God. He's the only one. I won't bow my knee to any man, much less that descendant of Agag. No way that I'm going to bow down. Verse 4. He told him he was a Jew, and he told him what the Jews stood for. Now, verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not and did him reverence, he was full of wrath. So he went in to see the king, first order of business. And they checked off the paperwork. And then Haman said, by the way, are you aware that we have a race of people scattered throughout all the empire that don't obey the law? They got their own system. They cannot be integrated in the community. They just go their own. And beside that, he said, they've cornered all the money. Now, I got a plan. That 1 year from today, we will exterminate all the Jews off the face of the earth. And that everybody in the world is commanded 1 year from today to kill every Jew in their community. And he said, he gave him a figure as to how much this would bring into the treasury, too. Xerxes, verse 10, took his ring. Write it up. Sign it. Now, it's interesting, in this period of history, there's a saying that we still hear today, and that is, the laws of the Medes and Persians cannot be changed. See, these kings pretended they were God, and to ever change anything they had said would show a weakness, so they couldn't reverse themselves. So when the king gave him his ring, signed that decree, it was irreversible under their law. Well, they've had their first confrontation. 13 has the heart of the decree, and the letters were sent into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even the 13th day of the 12th month. And to confiscate all their property. Well, how'd they make out in their first confrontation? Death penalty. Not only on Mordecai, but on every other one of his race. Now, let me ask you a question. Were the ancestors of Jesus Christ somewhere out there? What's the real plot? And who's behind it? The real plot's Satan. And this is an attempt to prevent Jesus Christ from ever being born. Right? That's what it is. Well, you see in chapter 4 that Mordecai didn't show up for work the next day. He put on his mourning garments. And the word got to Esther. Mordecai didn't show up for work. He's spending all of his time praying. So she said, what's the problem? So he sent her a Xerox copy of the decree. He had access to it. It speaks for itself. And then he wrote a note on the bottom. And he said, now you're in a key position. You must go to the king and ask him to do the impossible, to reverse the decree. And Esther sent word back. And now, Mordecai, you know better than that. You know that nobody goes to see the king without an appointment. In most cases, without being requested. And if somebody has the audacity to go into the king's presence without being invited, he has one of two courses. One is to say, come on in. And the other is to ignore the person. And this is the automatic sign for the guards, off with their head. She said the percentage is not too good in this. So Mordecai sent word back. Verse 14. And you see some of the greatness of this man. He says, if you altogether hold your peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. Why, God is not going to let this happen. I know he isn't. But you have an opportunity to be the heroine. Don't miss it. Don't miss your chance. Don't muff it. So Esther said, sent word back. They were sending notes back and forth. Okay. I've surrounded myself with all Jews who know how to pray. All my servants. Now you get together, everybody you know can pray. And we are not going to eat or drink for 3 days and three nights. We're just going to pray. And she said, after that 3 days and three nights is over, I'll walk into the king. And she said, verse 16, if I perish, I perish. Now, how do you like her performance? Yeah. Can't expect anything more of that out of her, can you? Do you think there's that much merit in an empty stomach? I don't think there is. Have you ever gone without food for 3 days and three nights? You think God is really interested in an empty stomach? I don't think he's that interested in an empty stomach. But I think he's interested in perseverance. Somebody that wants something bad enough to give up something. Try to get it. Well, she felt that the king's heart could be prepared in 3 days and three nights for her entrance and her request. And it was. Verse 5, chapter 5, she really fixed herself up. And she broke out all the Chanel number 5 that she had, put on the royal robes, really dolled herself up. And when she walked into his presence, I mean, she was so irresistible that he just couldn't say a thing except, ah. Yes, come on in. Come on in. And he says, tell me what your request is, and if you ask for half of the kingdom, I'll give it to you. Just like that. Whatever you want, even if it's half the kingdom, it's all yours. That's verse 3. Now, Esther was probably the one who originated the idea that the shortest way to a man's heart is through his stomach. And she said, I don't want half your old kingdom. All I want to do is throw a banquet in honor of your newly appointed deputy. That's all I want, banquet. So the king said, send a messenger, tell Haman, be a banquet, palace, tomorrow night, 7:30. So, all set up. Well, Haman got the word. He went home to his friends. And he was so puffed up with pride, they could hardly stand it. He said, a few days ago, the king picked me out as number one. Now, what do you know? The queen is having a special banquet just in my honor. Just me. Not only does the king think I'm the greatest, but now the queen thinks so too. I was at a luncheon once where the new mayor, newly inaugurated mayor of Minneapolis, was speaking. And I'm sure it wasn't true, but he told it on himself. He said, after the inauguration, the ceremony is over, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. But he said, after a great day like this, I couldn't just go home and go to bed. So I drove my wife up to the 7 highest points, one after another in Minneapolis. We looked down on my empire. And she wasn't quite as excited as I was. So in order to try to get her to appreciate her good fortune, he said, now, have you ever thought just how many really important people there are in the state of Minnesota? You know, there's the governor and a couple senators and the mayor of Minneapolis, you know. And then he asked her, who are the really important people in the state of Minnesota, and how many are there? And about 2:30 in the morning, she said, I don't know how many there are, but I'll tell you this, there's one less than you think. So here's Haman, you know. You know how many really important people are in the world? Well, there's a king, there's a queen, and little old me. But he said, I can't enjoy it. Because as I was coming out of the gate on my home here, verse 9 of chapter 5, old Mordecai, everybody else got up, bowed down. He didn't even get out of his chair. He just gave me the evil eye from the time I came in sight till I went out. And he said, I can't enjoy this position as long as that man treats me like that. And his wife said, verse 14 of chapter 5, well, you've got all the authority you need. The death penalty's on him anyway. Why don't you get it over with? Hang him. So Haman called out the night crew, and he says, build a gallows on the highest hill in the city so that everybody can see it, and we'll hang him right away. Verse 14, and the thing pleased Haman, he caused the gallows to be made. Now, chapter 6, most fascinating of all. The king was having a bad night, and he'd been told, you know, if you can't sleep, read something. So he called for something to read. His servants very wisely brought him the record of his own exploits. Read about what a great man he was. And he was reading along in there, and he read this account of the attempted assassination. And he was shocked by it. He said, here's a man who saved my life, and I didn't have a public ceremony honoring him. Why, what do the people think about my life if I don't honor the man that saved it? He couldn't believe that there'd be a slip-up like that, that the man who saved his life wasn't honored. So he said in verse 3, what honor and dignity has been done to Mordecai? Then the king's servants, minister and him said, there's nothing done for him. And we've got to correct that. Now, Haman didn't sleep very well that night either. He was kind of new in the job. I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't hang the king's number one servant without checking through with him. So he got up real early in the morning and went over there. And it happened that he walked right next to the king's bedroom at the same time the king says, we got to do something about this. And when he heard his footsteps, he said, who's that out there? And they said, verse 5, Haman. King said, send him in. Verse 6, so Haman came in. And the king said unto him, what shall be done unto the man whom the king delights to honor? Now, Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? First I'm the deputy. Queen throws a banquet. And now he wants to heap some more on me. What can he do? But he had it all figured out. And he said, here's what you do. Verse 8, let the royal apparel be brought which the king uses to wear, and the horse that the king rides upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head. Let him be king for a day. Take the king's robes, his crown, and his horse. Verse 9, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delights to honor, bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, make haste. Take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew. Now, who was the king's most noble prince?
Amen.
Who got the job? Haman got the job. He got over there early in the morning. He said, make haste immediately. Here's the robe. Here's the crown. Get Mordecai. Put it on him. And you will escort him through the capital all day long. Make all the people bow down to him all day long. And you'll make the announcement. Everybody's to bow down to Mordecai. Now, Haman had a bad day. Can you believe that he forgot about the banquet? But he did. He was so upset by what had happened, he forgot about the banquet. Esther and Xerxes went ahead and started without him. They sent word, you know, he's late. So he got there, a little late. And as the banquet was going on, that day, they really had the money. They had talent. That banquet room was fixed up in a way, well, let's put it this way. Anything that money could buy or human talent could create had gone into that banquet hall. They ate on a couch at the Last Supper, Christ and his disciples. Laid out on a couch. Do you ever try to eat? Went on an elbow? Apparently you enjoy the food more. You ought to try it sometime. But Esther had her couch. Xerxes had his. And Haman had his. And they were all eating away, you know, close enough to talk. So as they got into the conversation, Xerxes said to Esther, I know more about women than you think. There's something else going on in that pretty little head of yours. You didn't risk your life just for this banquet. Now, what is your real request? And I reaffirm, I'll give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom. That's for chapter 7, verse 2. I think this is the most touching incident in here. As Esther said, if I found favor in your sight, and if it pleases you, my petition is for my life and the life of all my people, because the death penalty has been pronounced upon every one of us. She said, now, if your decree had been to sell us into slavery, I would have held my tongue. She knew that God had built a lot of character in the last few hundred years through the adversity they'd gone through. But she said, slavery, yes. Death, no. So the king began to turn things over in his mind, and he remembered something about a decree, but he couldn't remember the details. But he said, yeah, I remember this. I didn't realize you were involved in it. Who's behind this? And Esther just pointed for the third couch. And she said, verse 6, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman, right there. Now, it's interesting to study Xerxes in his leadership. Xerxes lost the Persian Empire to the Greeks in the Battle of Salamis. He was the last of them. I don't know how good a leader he was, but when something subjective got involved, he could be very explosive. He got so angry that he couldn't talk. So he walked out on the patio to cool off. Here, his newly appointed deputy, only important thing he'd done now was to pass the death penalty on the queen. Now, verse 7, he went outside to cool off. Now, Haman saw things weren't going too good. So he crawled up on Esther's couch where he could look her straight in the eye. Probably, you know, candlelight. The king got cooled off a little bit. He came back in. Light was dim. And he saw Haman on a couch with Esther over there. And he thought the worst. And then he got speechless again. Well, the people around him interpreted what he was doing. And one of them whipped out a black cloth and put it on Haman's head. He saw, you know, death penalty. And one of them, to make a few brownie points to the king, said, he built the gallows for Mordecai. And the king says, verse 9, hang him thereon. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Well, that should have ended things, shouldn't it? But there was a problem. The decree could not be changed. So a few days later, at the risk of her life, this was getting to be a habit again, Esther went into the king. And he says, I've killed Haman, all of his sons. I've given all of his estate to Mordecai. Now, what more do you want? And she said, there's the little problem of the decree. 8 months from now, it will be executed. Now, the king was shrewd. And he said, now, I don't know the answer. But you know the problem. A king cannot reverse himself on any issue. But you and Mordecai seem to be pretty good in figuring things out. He pulled off his ring, gave it to her, and says, write something up and sign it. That was quite a challenge for them to come up with a new decree. But they did. And here's what it said. It went out, you see, in verse 9 to everybody. Verse 11, wherein the king granted the Jews which were in every city to gather themselves together and to stand for their life, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all the power of the people in province that would assault them, both little ones and women, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. And furthermore, verse 3 of chapter 9, and the rulers of the provinces, the lieutenants, the deputies, and officers of the king helped the Jews. So the decree went out then. An amended decree, the first decree is still valid. Every Jew is to be executed. But every Jew is ordered to defend himself. And every officer of the empire is commanded to help them. Is that a pretty shrewd decree? All the people out there in this empire were not dumb. And you know what their reaction was? That, the king admitted he was wrong. He's not divine after all. He made a mistake. I don't think they took any great pleasure in seeing a whole race of people exterminated. And they were glad. But they knew something supernatural is going on. Now, we don't want to miss this. One of the greatest ingatherings that had ever occurred into the kingdom of God occurred as a result of this. Verse 17 of chapter 8. And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. What happened? They turned to the God of the Jews throughout this huge empire. May have been the greatest ingathering into the family of God that had ever occurred in history up to this point. Well, how are things going in the confrontations? Now, you would have thought that the devil who was behind this plot would have copped out, wouldn't you? But he didn't. And there was quite a slaughter on the day the decree was effective, but there wasn't a Jew that was hurt in the whole thing. You know, the devil, interesting to get some insights into him, I think, is dominated by passion more than reason in some cases. Now, if you want an illustration of that, when's the last time you lost your temper? Do you ever remember doing anything you're proud of as you look back on it? When you lost your temper. Passion can overrule reason. The devil was so close to preventing Christ being born that he just wouldn't give up. A few years later, he showed this same quality again. After Christ had been crucified and they had him in the grave, his representatives got together and said, now the disciples said he's going to be resurrected. And if, in order to fool the people, after dark, they'll go steal the body and hide it. And then they'll tell everybody, he's resurrected, he's resurrected. And the last error will be worse than the first. So we can't have this happen. So let's put a Roman seal on the grave that nobody except a government official can remove. And then we'll set up a six-soldier guard, two of them on duty, two on, eight off. And they'll stand there to see that nobody steals the body. What the devil did was established witnesses to the resurrection. You know, the public might have bought that the disciples stole the body and hid it. They'd have probably bought it. But he set up two witnesses for it. He overstepped himself, you see. Now, when the word, the soldiers, you know, they left in a hurry with the events going on that we're celebrating this week. And they went to the high priest, and the high priest said, now, if you get called on the witness stand, if there's an investigation into this, boy, didn't things go from bad to worse? He said, your testimony will be, while we were asleep, the disciples stole the body and hid it. What kind of a witness who's on a witness stand, what kind of credibility does he have when he says, now, while I was asleep, this and this happened? So he really hung himself on that one. And we're glad that there were witnesses to the resurrection, because the soldiers went in and said, man, that's what we saw happen. Stone rolled away, and the angel was there, and he arose. Well, to wrap this up, in the earlier session, I'm glad we can tie these together. What was God all about with the Jews? What was his two main things he wanted to do through them? What was the first one? Ancestors of Christ. The devil tried to blot it out. The second? Evangelize the world. How'd they do? In here. They preserved the ancestry of Christ. They evangelized the world. Now, this wasn't the first time this had happened. But I mentioned this morning that the northern kingdom lasted till 722, the southern till 588. This was about 1,500 years after Abraham was born. But for the most part, during that period, they didn't get the job done. The day they went into captivity, every journalist who knew the scripture wrote the epitaph of the Jews and said, God is totally thwarted and frustrated. But you know, they hadn't been in captivity a year until there were three guys named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that were commanded to bow down to the image. He said, we won't do it. And the king said, there's nobody tells the king and what they'll do and what they won't. I'm the guy who does the telling. And so, you know, he commanded them to throw gasoline on the fire, make it 10 times hotter. And then he turned to them and he said, I'm going to give you a second chance. If you don't do it, in you go. And he says, can your God deliver you out of that flame? They said, we don't know. We don't know whether he can or not. But we'll tell you one thing that we're sure of. We won't bow down to that thing. You can put that in your pipe and smoke it. So Nebuchadnezzar got the shock of his life as he leaned back to glory in his power. And as he looked into the furnace, he turned to one of his aides and he said, didn't we throw three in the flame? Daniel chapter 3, verse 24. Did not we cast three men bound in the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto him, True, O king. He answered and said, Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt on them. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. We threw three. The fire was so hot that the people who threw them in were cremated. And he said, I see four. He said, Come out, fellows. They came out. And in 28, Nebuchadnezzar said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him. And this was the hardest thing for him to swallow. He said, And have changed the king's word. I said, This is the way it'll be. And you changed my word. And yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own. Well, later on, old Nebuchadnezzar was converted. And we've got his prayer in chapter 4. Verse 37, last verse, he says, Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth, and in his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. His testimony is in the opening part of Daniel 4. He addressed his testimony, Nebuchadnezzar the king, Daniel 4:1, and to all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. So by human evaluation, the story was over when the Jews were captured. But they hadn't been in there any time until Nebuchadnezzar did what the Jews had never done in all their history. And that was to give a worldwide witness as to who the true and living God was. Daniel served for 70 years behind the kings, Nebuchadnezzar and the others. Daniel really softened him up after he interpreted the decree and told him, Daniel 2:20, Daniel answered and said, Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might is his. So Daniel softened him up. One man, first of all, then three, and then you got a king issuing a decree to the whole world. Very amazing that after the Babylonian Empire was overthrown and a Persian general by the name of Dobryas took over. You know, he put in the number one spot to run the Babylonian Empire that they just conquered? Daniel. He set up three presidents and put Daniel in charge, the other two. And you know from Daniel 6 that they couldn't collect any graft off the kingdom because Daniel was honest. He ran four departments. Department of State, Secretary of the Treasury. He was over all interior affairs, and I don't know what his other cabinet position was. So you remember how the other two guys, they said, we can never get any graft as long as he's in. So they put the CIA on him. And they watched him round the clock. And they found out he just had one peculiar habit. And that was, no matter what was going on, he had dismissed the meeting, or excuse himself, and pray three times a day with his face toward Jerusalem. And they said, now, if there's a way to get to him, that's it. So, you know, they went in to see Gobryas. and told him that in order to secure your empire, we've got to really build you up. No, otherwise you may not be too secure as a new ruler here. So we'd like to put out a decree that nobody in the empire can ask a request of anybody but you for the next 30 days. Anybody that does will be thrown in the den of lions. Well, Gobryas thought that was a good deal. You know, it sounded like a good deal. So they got their tape recorder, their camera crew, went over to Daniel's house. They knew that he always prayed in the evening. So, as long as I'm telling the truth, go along with me. If I don't tell the truth, stop me. But Daniel saw him out there. So he said, well, that's not worth the risk. I'll skip praying. Or he said, I think I'll pull a curtain. Now, verse 10 says, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house and his witness being in his chamber toward Jerusalem. He kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. Well, they said, fellows, we got the evidence. Well, they marched into the king and they said, now who do you suppose is the first man who violated the decree? Daniel. And Gobryas couldn't believe it. He knew he'd been tricked. He got all the legal staff in. And he said, now there must be some way that we can break this decree and reverse it. His legal staff worked on it all day. I said, no way. There is no way. So the king dismissed the orchestra for that night. They threw Daniel in the lion's den. And he did a lot of thinking. I think he, probably added up everything Daniel told him about God. And he believed it. So he did 2 things. He made up his mind he was going to go down and get Daniel out in the morning. The decree didn't say how long he had to stay there. And the second thing, he took out his success diary and wrote down the names of everybody that was involved in the plot. Next morning, he went down the den of lions, came to the den, verse 20. He said, Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God, whom you serve continually, able to deliver you. Daniel said, coming right up. So Daniel came out. King handed his list to the soldier. Round them all up. They rounded them all up, and threw them in the lion's den. And the scripture says in verse 24, Daniel 6, that the lions tore them apart before they ever hit the bottom. They were that hungry. But here's the point I want to come to. 25. Darius, I don't know how this got changed, but he's the Gobryas of history, wrote, verse 25, to all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. Is that a wide enough audience for you? Everybody in the earth. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. So forth. How about a testimony? Is that a good one? So you see, God tried to get the Jews to evangelize the world. Apart from a few that we mentioned this morning, great majority preoccupied with what they wanted. But God used 6 of them to evangelize the world on 3 occasions. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel under Nebuchadnezzar, under Gobryas, and under Mordecai and Esther, Xerxes. was maneuvered so that the whole world became aware of the working of God. 30 years after Daniel's death, Mordecai replaced him as the deputy emperor of the world. He had an even stronger position than Daniel ever had because he replaced Haman as the deputy of the world. That's the last chapter of Esther and verse 3. Well, you want a book of the Bible? That's